Welcome everyone to the first National Dialogue podcast. I'm Nick Benedell, the founding dean of Gordon Institute of Business Science, and I was asked to facilitate this discussion. The proposal for a new National Dialogue was put on the table by In Transformation Initiative, Democracy Works Foundation, Hans Seidel Foundation, the Chelimo Motlanthe Foundation, and the Gordon Institute of Business Science. Due to COVID-19, as well as the mismanagement and stagnation that were structurally present well before the pandemic, South Africa really appears to be in a crisis. As we all know, poverty has increased dramatically, and there's a failure of leadership in many senses, in both politics, the state, business, and in civil society. We are all struggling to find the right answers and actions to move us forward and deal with the challenges we face. Some of the questions that were raised during the debate include, can these issues be a catalyst for change? And could people in the center ground have the well-being of South Africans at heart, create a new consensus around how to fix the country and bring new energy to these questions? These were closed discussions held virtually, where 70 of the country's most prominent and influential thinkers, policymakers, and leaders gave their inputs about these matters. The first of these sessions was to get a perspective from these leaders on the status quo in South Africa. It's not our intention to create a forum for dialogue only, but rather to explore specific areas that need attention and action. Enjoy the inputs of these highly influential people who all contribute in practical ways on a daily basis on how to remedy the many challenges we have. I hope you enjoy the podcast, and we will be continuing to do this work in different forms in the time ahead. So first up, we have ANC veteran Mavuso Msimang, then former governor of the Reserve Bank, Jill Marcus, followed by former DA leader, Musi Maimane.
I've got a very unstable network, so I'll switch off. I thank you very much, and I greet everybody who is in the room, in the meeting. I mean, let me start with the obvious. South Africa is in a state of crisis, and this is evidenced by an economy that has shed millions of jobs, and B, led to a significant increase in levels of poverty in the country. Contributors to this are obviously COVID-20, and let me say, also corruption and ineptitude in the public sector. This is particularly manifested by the corruption is made worse by the fact that political players feature very prominently in it. So we're facing a leadership crisis in the ANC, the governing party, and it's rendering the country very difficult to manage. We are actually, I don't think that this is in any way alarmist, edging towards what people call a failed state. Its manifestations would be, for instance here, the unprincipled attacks on the judiciary, which is being accused of corruption and politicization without people even bothering to provide any shred of evidence. It's clearly a political game played by people in very influential positions. Then there is the defiance of the Constitutional Court judgment by Jacob Zuma and the dismal failure by the ANC to react appropriately, namely by condemning Jacob Zuma's actions in no uncertain terms, and also by censoring him. Either falls in line or he's out. In a normal organization, it would be that, and he would need to do that very quickly. Then there is also the failure of the ANC to use the occasion of that blockade, or is it a vigil, at Nkandla, to actually once and for all tell the people who call themselves MK, MVA, to to get off the public scene and to stop wearing military uniforms. The militarization of politics is what these people are doing. You can imagine if Kufut and Battalion 32 also decided to display their impressive uniforms to support whatever political causes they wished to. This is very dangerous. It's been allowed to go on for too long, and it is failure of leadership that has kept it going. Then there is a state of lawlessness in the country, an increase in criminality, and a sense that these things can be done with impunity. Also, you have an increase in social discourse. In other words, racism is on the increase, and unfortunately, it's fueled also at very senior political levels. This is not to say people have not been racist in this country, but when it is being practiced by for a political purpose, it becomes that much more difficult and contributes that much more to the instability of the country. But it is also class-based, this social incohesion, whatever the right term is. We also have very militant, politicized xenophobia. Yes, people fear that they might lose jobs and all of that uninformed stuff. The politicians are not stepping forward to explain how these things work out, to explain, by the way, that the people they are chasing away from South Africa, the people who made it possible for them to be in power and government today, and all of those things. But the xenophobia has got very political connotation, the burning of the trucks that carry things. This is being used as a political statement to achieve the objectives that people are intended to achieve. The conclusion, because I'm talking about things that everybody knows here, is that unfortunately, politics, national politics, is in a very powerless state. The opposition parties have actually failed abjectly to capitalize on the really serious weaknesses within the ANC to gain the confidence of the electorate. I mean, it's a real problem. What's to be done? I mean, we can't ask them, help them to fall in line with what needs to be done in order to be relevant to our politics. But there is a call, I think, Njabulo Ndebele, whom I saw there, was that people must start imagining ways of empowering stakeholders outside politics. How do we reach out to civil society and make sure that the corruption is not permitted by them? It happens to be ANC because they're in power. There are others who are corrupt, but the corruption that is implemented by people who are in charge of, who have volunteered to serve the people must get a retort from the people when those volunteers no longer serve the purpose. Really the challenge which I wish today or more likely at other times we could try to put our heads around is how do we get society to say, no, we aren't going to accept leadership or representation by corrupt people.
Thanks very much, and thanks for the very interesting contributions so far. I will try to add something. First of all, I think we should see South Africa in the context globally, because that's also very shifted. It has shifted very rapidly. And it is in many ways the question of a pre-fascist period. If you looked at what's happened in the United States, if you look at what's happening in Europe, the potential of where that goes to is very high. And in many ways, the boundaries have been, the normal boundaries that inhibit certain behavior have been removed. So people can say and do and act in any way it is now permissible So you can be racist, you can be misogynist, you can actually be quite abusive to any minority, whether it is xenophobic or female or anything else. It is now acceptable and it is now your right. I think the second question that is prevailing is that, in fact, that right crosses boundaries that progressive people or Democrats do not. And therefore, there is, if you like, an unequal power relation within that, because what that is doing across the globe, including in South Africa, is you appeal to the basest instincts that people have. So it is a blaming culture. It is other people's fault. It is the foreigner. It is the rich. It is the whites. It is monopoly capital who are to blame for your circumstance. And therefore, a culture of entitlement and impunity prevails. And within that, I think an overarching question across the world, but certainly in South Africa, is there is a loss of trust from a very high level of trust by the population across the board in the political standing and history of the ANC to one of a lack of trust, a lack of confidence. People don't see themselves in the future. They see themselves quite despairing. I mean, generally people have a sense that their children will have a better life than themselves. I don't think that's the case in South Africa today. And that affects the question of hope. So when we look at mobilizing civil society, it is extremely difficult to mobilize effectively when people do not see themselves in that future and see themselves overwhelmed. I think in many ways we also create, while I think it's very necessary to have a full understanding and theoretical, practical base to what we want to do, I think we overcomplicate things as South Africa. We will theorize to the end of the earth. But practically, what are the key issues? The first issue that faces people today is food. You have to have food on the table. People who do not have food on the table do not necessarily rebel. They actually just withdraw. They're becoming incapable. We talk about education, but if your child is going to school hungry, there is no way they are learning. The inequalities are increasing, not decreasing. And when you look at it in terms of that, we talk about online learning and smart cities and so on. But in many towns, the town will have internet, the townships don't. So e-learning is not possible. You do not have access. You do not have access to data. You do not have food on the table. So those are very critical issues. The second one is energy. We can talk about wanting to build electric cars till the cows come home because we can't have electricity in our homes. And that is not resolved. So, you know, there are key elements that need to be looked at. So for me, there are five areas that we should focus on as a country and work around. And that is food security, energy and water, which are both very, very important, education, healthcare, and the sense that people have a confidence in themselves. One of the things that in the analysis that we've had from both Moletsi and Mavuso that is missing for me is why do we steal the extent to which we do? Because don't forget, this is not your older generation. A lot of the people who are stealing like this are people who have been through the education system, who have degrees. So are we questioning the quality of the degree? It's a different story, but these are educated people. We talk about incompetence in the civil service because of an appointment process. It's not that at all. The civil service attracts precisely because of the reasons you have explained that you've outlined, is that it is the civil service that is the vehicle through which wealth is created, wealth is generated, personal wealth is generated. So the additional question to that is that people simply don't care. Those in office simply do not care. They can be out partying while the rest of us are dealing with the basic realities. And it's a very sad state of affairs. Part of the challenge is we keep on looking to an individual. We like the Russians, like a czar. We want a czar. We want somebody in charge. Now, we all want to have a leadership that is effective, but we don't necessarily want a czar. But in essence, what we're seeing is we look to a strong individual to resolve the problems. We do not look to the general, although I'm not talking about the group that is on this call, but generally speaking, we look to an individual to resolve. If only so-and-so was there, if only so-and-so was there. reality doesn't work that way. And therefore, if we want to deal with the issues that have been so clearly outlined by previous speakers, is a way in which we have to mobilize civil society in a manner that they see themselves as the vehicle, as the way in which they can resolve problems. And that requires confidence, and it requires trust, and it requires self-confidence. And that is part of the challenge that we do not have. In addition, we do not take sufficient account. We talk about how to deal with things in very much stuck in an old paradigm. You know, the motor forces of the revolution become the way in which we explain everything. But reality is the new technology means a very different way of organizing, mobilizing, talking to each other. It has also meant the death of expertise, because you with huge knowledge, experience, expertise are equated with somebody who has an opinion and an uninformed opinion on the social media, and the two are regarded as equal. And therefore the challenge that you have to communicate effectively is deepened by the way in which social media creates, especially because it is provoked or assisted by the algorithms that generate like minds to meet each other. So you have the leading into a like-minded group, so you get a group think that is very easy to organize, mobilize, and miscommunicate. And part of the challenge that you have in this era is what is real and what is not real, what is false and what is truth. Because the visibility of things, what you see, what you hear, you don't know whether, how many times do you get something and say, is that real or has it been fabricated? Has that been created? Because the ability to tell the truth with so much data, not information, and so much access to data and so much access to the manipulation, it's very difficult for people to know what is real and what is not real. And that's going to be a very big challenge going forward, the ability to tell separate the lies from the truth. And the final point I would want to make on this is, yes, we have all of these issues, but we have allowed ourselves to be locked into the past and blame. So we want retribution and redress by locking ourselves into the past and what others have. We have not created a way in which we see ourselves shaping the future that redresses the past. And that for me is a fundamental disenabler to people motivating a way for change and tackling the corruption in leadership. The impunity with which people behave. I mean, take one very simple example for me is the panel discussion that was just held with the former president on it at the same time that he has just walked out and just been defying the Zondo Commission. It's a juxtaposition of a value system. The impunity with which those who have been accused of corruption behave, including within the party and outside the party and within ministers and without ministers. And we should not just look at this as a ministerial issue. This is something that pervades our society. It is seen as that is the way to go, because otherwise we have nothing. And the have-nots, and that gap is growing unbelievably, exponentially, and the despair that is out there in reality is totally unacceptable to be a way of South African society to function. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and good morning, everybody. And I want to appreciate the inputs that have taken place. I'd hope to achieve what Moeletsi couldn't, which is to speak last and sum up what everyone has been saying. But it seems like that will fast become an impossibility. So, Nick, thanks for setting up the session. I think more than anything, the crisis that we face as a country is in many ways the delegitimization of the 1994 consensus. The arranged marriages, both racially and constitutionally, is something that is fast becoming threatened. And so whether I accept that point or not, or whether you do or not, we have to ask the question, what is to be done about that consensus and how do we take it forward? Because part of those consensus is at one level it established constitutionality, which however you view the former president's actions or however you view the current governing party's actions, the direct challenge to that constitutional order. And I think that is a question that all of us as a citizenship must grapple with. And I think the second question on the table is, part of the outcomes or maybe unintended consequences of the 94 consensus is that it gave political power to elitism, which perpetuates the very point that Joe Marcus makes, which is, it has enhanced profound inequality. It's allowed politics to be a game of elites and really a proliferation of poverty like never before. And so the net consequence is that, in fact, we do live in many South Africa. So there's often a part of me that says, to which South Africa are we discussing? Are we discussing a South Africa of the elite, or is it discussing a South Africa of the poor? Because both the trajectory in both those sectors often seems to be different, and also the language of politics that is spoken to each of those constituencies varies. So I do think we have to, if anything is to emerge post this conversation, we have to ask, what is the consensus that emerges post-COVID? Because COVID gives us a moment, if there's a global reset and a South African reset, what is the consensus that we take it going forward? I think the second question that I kind of go grappling with is, if you attend to the question of elitism, where is the degree of advocacy on behalf of citizens occurring? Because by and large, it would feel that if the interests of the elites, and certainly my experience from a parliamentary point of view, the interests of the elites are relatively well represented, and they seem to have access in issues. But effectively, the issues that confront poor South Africans are often not represented. And that's why, as a net consequence, you can see the demise of local government with absolute impunity and no consequence. Or you can see the conversation occurring, where in fact, I think the issues of the poor are spoken about in prose and in sloganism, but it's got no consequence. So I do think we have to deal with the fundamental question as to how do we put the poor and the marginalized and the excluded from an advocacy point of view to be put in the center of our political dialogue, and ultimately allow for an increasing level of activism. I must confess that politics has become a professional game, and therefore the net consequence is that we've distanced political leadership away from citizens themselves. And so if I speak to an average member of parliament in answer to a simple question, when last did you engage an ordinary citizen, if I could define ordinary in that sense, I would take a guess at saying that very few and very hardly happens, because the systems are created that the conversation happens at an elite level. I think we have to furthermore enhance this second dilemma, not only about an advocacy for those who are marginalized, but a high level of accountability. I think the confrontation of the legal fraternity, but I think also corporate South Africa has found itself in a space where it simply is not accountable, whether for the wrongdoings of what happens. But I see environmentally South Africa is not. I have been deeply angered personally at what is occurring in the Vaal Dam as a failure of all layers of government. But the simple fact is that we become more outraged about what takes place in the looting of public funds, as we call corruption. But we often fail to assess the competence of the state as it delivers a very fundamental issue such as water in a dam that provides water to 45% of the citizens of Gauteng. And I think if roles reversed, I think this presents to me the nexus of what is a great challenge. If energy was the first, water becoming the second, this is only but a flag that all of us ought to be raising far more vehemently than what I think it's getting. To not depress, or certainly to not, I think what this does is that it presents for South Africa a great moment of reformation. I think it asks us the question as to how do we get back to citizens and get them more engaged. And this brings me to, I think, to me, where I think the most crucial component of what we can get back to. If we can break down that sense of elitism being a political game, the sense of political power being captured for private use or party political use, as we see in nations like even the Chinese Communist Party, how do we put citizens back on? And therefore, I stand with those who really, as President Motlanthe has already stated, the idea of reforming our electoral system. Because if we don't do that, we have no incapability of putting citizens' power back into their hands and giving them the capability to meaningfully contribute to our democracy. I do think it's a period of reformation economically. I think it is unsustainable that, and perhaps maybe to Jill Marcus's point about a pre-fascist society, part of it is also the labeling of economic terms in a manner that stops engaging with the idea but dismisses us on the basis of just whatever we label it to be. So I do think in some instances our economy is not competitive, and therefore we have to ask the basic question without labeling it as either neoliberal or whatever language you want to use that emerges from social media and digitization. But how do we engage with new ideas that seek to modernize our economy so that it works for more people? I think that question must at least guide, and I tend to disagree with the view that there's a shared consensus around the NDP, because I actually don't think it's a living document that people have input or have worked with. I do ask the genuine question, which is how do we break down the economic question so that we can build a far more inclusive economy going forward? So I think what posits for South Africa is, I would think, perhaps maybe four or five things that we have to answer is the firstly, how do we globalize better? I think the post-COVID consensus has to answer that question. How do we deal with the continent at large? Because whether I accept it or not, we have to think, I don't pontificate on the issue of African solutions for African problems, but I really think that we have to think broadly about what does it mean for this continent and how does South Africa play its role in the world. As economies are transitioning, I fear that South Africa has been left behind. We're not thinking harder enough about what the next revolution is, what does the green economy mean, how do we make it much more inclusive. So I do think that globalization question will have to be answered as it speaks to also issues of immigration and healthcare. So that's a very vital question. Secondly, yes, I subscribe to the doctrine that says we need to build a capable state, but we need to also build a modern state or in a modern economy. I had to go do fingerprints at the police station the other day, not for criminal purposes, if anyone was worried, but as I got there, it struck me that I was still using the age-old, what felt like the age-old John Foster Square style of fingerprint state taking. And I just thought to myself, here we are trying to modernize a very essential function of the state, which is crime prevention, yet I couldn't take fingerprints digitally. I had to do it in the old way. They had to be posted to Pretoria. And eventually when they got back to me 6 weeks later, told me I have no criminal record. But if I was a criminal, I'd have 6 weeks at least leeway to find refuge elsewhere. So I think that's the modernization of the state and its function is a key question, but also of our own economic models. I think, for many young people, as Mark Haywood puts the question, that we're living in a fairly archaic state, we feel, in a state of affairs. I think thirdly, we have to ask the question about how do we decentralize services, because there's no doubt about the failure of local government. I often boldly say, maybe in rhetoric, that local government capture will make state capture look like a picnic, because I think what actually occurs at local government is something that should worry about. When I look at towns, the stretch between Mount Aleph to Butterworth in the Eastern Cape, for towns to not have water for weeks on end has now become common cause. And I think this becomes a failure of local government that isn't often given the media attention or the political attention it needs. So this issue of how do we decentralize becomes vital. And then I think we need to think about how do we deconcentrate certain sectors of our economy and ensure that, particularly in the rural-urban divide, we deal with economic impetus in rural areas. That becomes a fundamental question. Otherwise, you are going to end up with a situation where areas are concentrated, the infrastructure is not holding, the long-term sustainability of those areas is questionable. And I think South Africa needs to grapple with these questions. And then lastly, if we're going to broaden the leadership question, it has to eventually emerge and citizens take an essential part of that. And that's why I always hold the view that how do we enhance active citizenship? How do we enhance civil society to take a more serious role? So I think the political project is one at fray at the moment, and we need a new consensus. So the exciting bit for me is that given the conditions, given the presence of people in this room, really, I think room for reformation is possible. And really, I do think if we get the conversation right, we could really charter a new way that South Africa could lead for the benefit of the continent and also for the benefit of the global conversation. So I hope, Nick, that really enters the conversation with some real questions that I think this moment requires of our nation. So thank you so much.